From BDWPS.com and BDWPS Podcast, this is Year of the Bowie, an 8-episode podcast series that tells the story of David Bowie. I'm your host, Andy. If you haven't listened to the first 3 episodes yet, I would recommend giving them a listen before proceeding with today's show. If you like what you hear on this month's episode, I would love if you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. Just search Year of the Bowie. Also, a quick heads up that today's episode is a little longer than the last 3. We're about to enter some of the most important years of David Bowie's career. There's a lot to talk about, so let's get right back into the story of David Bowie. David Bowie's 1969 release, The Man Who Sold the World, squandered on the British charts. But manager Tony DeFries felt they might have more success in the U.S., like Bowie's friend Mark Bolan was currently having with his smash hit song, Bang a Gong, Get It On. To help promote the album across the pond, Mercury sent Bowie on an American media tour, thinking that once the media met him, they'd see his brilliance as an artist. When Bowie arrived in Silver Springs, Maryland in the winter of 1971, publicist Ron Oberman asked what he'd like to see first. Bowie's response, I want to see some American people. By the end of the night, Bowie would be hanging out at a suburban kegger with middle-class Americans. One can only imagine what it would be like to have David Bowie attend your kegger. After doing interviews with up-and-coming music journalists in New York City, Bowie insisted on visiting Greenwich Village, where his heroes like Bob Dylan, Jack Kerouac, Charles Mingus, and Lou Reed once reigned. His trip then took him to Chicago, where he tried to behave quiet and subdued for the Midwestern journalists. But once in Los Angeles, he let his flamboyant persona fly, wearing dresses and answering questions with outlandish responses. Near the end of his visit, a party was prepared by Mercury Records in hopes of having Bowie mingle with the Hollywood elite. Several interactions at the party resulted in song ideas for Bowie's upcoming album, Hunky Dory. At the party, he met author and artist Ultraviolet, a prominent member of Andy Warhol's entourage. Many fans believe Bowie's song Queen Bitch was inspired by this interaction, although Bowie has said in interviews that the song was inspired by Lou Reed. You be the judge. At the party, he hit it off with music producer Kim Fowley, and months later, the lyric, Look at Those Cavemen Go, would appear in the chorus of Bowie's Life on Mars, a lyrical nod to the 1960 Fowley-produced song, Alley-Oop. It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair, but her mommy is yelling no. Her daddy has told her to go, but her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a sad thing for she's lived it 10 times or more. She could spit in the eyes of fools as they ask her to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Oh man, look at those cavemen go. It's the freakiest show. Take a look at the low man beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if you'll ever know who's in the At this party, he was introduced to influential songwriters like Randy Newman, Tom Waits, and Rolling Stone journalist John Mendelsohn, who gave Bowie a copy of Iggy and the Stooges' Funhouse, an artist who would go on to be an important part of Bowie's legacy. Here's Iggy Pop discussing how strange it was to have someone actually like their music.
Nobody ever said they liked Iggy and the Stooges. You just didn't admit to that in 1970 unless you were cross-dressing or on some sort of drugs or had just dropped out of life or high school, really.
The American trip was unsuccessful in raising record sales of The Man Who Sold the World, but the connections made in the U.S. would come in handy in the coming years. He flew out of sunny Los Angeles and arrived in dreary England on a rainy day. News was also not good on the home front. Tony Visconti had decided to leave Bowie's camp due to an ongoing argument with manager Tony DeFries. It also didn't hurt that he had the opportunity to join T-Rex at the band's apex. Bowie's other partner in crime, Mick Ronson, had gone back to his hometown, feeling he was left in a holding pattern with Bowie in the U.S. Despite feeling a bit abandoned, Bowie embraced his lone wolf status, spending the next several months at home nurturing his now pregnant wife and also writing music on his piano and acoustic guitar. On May 30th, 1971, David became the father to a newborn baby boy named Zoe Bowie. The birth inspired him to write his legendary song of parenthood, Kooks. Here's a taste.
Will you stay in our lover's story? If you stay, you won't be sorry, 'cause we believe in you. Soon you'll grow, so take a chance with a couple of kooks hung up on romancing. Will you stay in our lover's story? If you stay, you won't be sorry, 'cause we believe in you. Soon you'll grow, so take a chance with a couple of kooks hung up on romancing.
Armed with a stockpile of new songs, Bowie booked time at Lund's Radio Luxembourg Studios, bringing in the local band Runk to fill the void left by Ronson and Visconti. Together, they would record 36 demos, many of the songs that would be featured on Bowie's next two albums. Today, these unreleased demos have become highly sought-after material for Bowie enthusiasts. Here's a clip of one of these unpolished demos. Tony DeFries thought the demos were fantastic, and he began setting up meetings with major labels in New York in hopes of landing a rock star-sized deal. Mercury attempted to extend Bowie's contract, but DeFries turned down the deal, telling the label, "Bowie will not record another note for Mercury Records." With tapes in hand, DeFries flew to New York City to visit the RCA offices. At the time, RCA had Elvis Presley on their label, but otherwise, their rock music division was lackluster, and they were in need of a new young star to beef up their roster. When RCA's Dennis Katz heard the demos, he knew he had found what the label had been looking for, something new, original, and exciting. DeFries returned to London with a 2-year, 3-album contract. Bowie had some recording to do. After playing the demos for Mick Ronson and Woody Woodmansey, his two former bandmates, the duo were excited to join up with Bowie again to do the new album. To fill Visconti's space, Bowie brought in studio musician Trevor Boulder to play bass. Here's Boulder discussing his first experience working with Bowie.
So I knew some of the bass lines and I knew the songs, but we never really rehearsed for Hunky Dory at all. It was, you're going, he plays the song on the piano or on the acoustic guitar. You get a run through, or maybe two if you're lucky, and then you start taking, you know. I mean, it's there goes that red light, and you have to get your bass lines together and stuff, and it's got to go down, you know. I mean, Hunky-Dory took about, I think it was 2 weeks to make.
Together, the foursome reworked Bowie's material. Ronson writing string arrangements for many of the songs, Wood Manzi finding unique and interesting ways to add flourishes to the drum tracks on songs like Changes and Queen Bitch. Here's Woody discussing the process.
So it was a completely different scene, and we'd been sort of anti-folk, to be honest. We weren't into folk music. I mean, it just wasn't rock and roll, you know. But then we heard the songs, and I guess our job was turning them into rock and roll things. We understood the rock and roll viewpoint and the playing.
Ken Scott had worked as the engineer on Bowie's past two efforts. But with Visconti out of the picture, Bowie asked Scott to take over as the producer. Here's Scott talking about his luck with meeting David Bowie.
I'm either the most blessed person on this planet or the luckiest bugger in the world. It's take your choice. There was this instinctive thing. We all knew our places. Ronno knew, Mick Ronson knew what he had to do. Woody Woodmansey, the drummer, knew what he had to do. It was a great team. And no, David never bothered about the sound particularly.
The album's title, Hunky Dory, was a sarcastic play on the album's focus on the chaos and uncertainty of life. The theme is explored from various perspectives. Kooks celebrates the birth of his son, while Quicksand deals with the death of his father. Life on Mars is a yearning for a better life, and Song for Bob Dylan is a plea for the return of a hero. This feeling of fear in confusing times is best seen on Oh You Pretty Things, a song that playfully presents apocalyptic imagery in hopeless times. Here's a taste.
Wake up your sleepy head, put on some clothes, shake up your bed, put another log on the fire for me. I made some breakfast and coffee. Look out my window, what do I see? A crack in the sky and a hand reaching down to me. All the nightmares came today, and it looks as though they're here to stay. What are we coming to? No room for me, no fun for you. I think about a world to come where the books were found by the golden ones, written in pain, written it all by a puzzled man who questioned what we were here for. All the strangers came today, and it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, you pretty things. Faces in golden rays. Don't kid yourself, they belong to you. They're the start of the coming race. The other's a bitch, we finished our news. Homo sapiens have outgrown their use. All the strangers came today, and it looks as though they're here to stay.
Album opener Changes would go on to be the most well-known song on the album, but it would take time for it to get off the ground. Changes is the perfect introduction to the album, the song looking at the end of the 60s and the unyielding force that is time. Today, Hunky Dory is considered one of Bowie's best albums, although it was overshadowed at the time of its release by Bowie's next project. As alluded to on the album's opening track, many changes were ahead for Bowie and his band.
Changes. Turn and face the strain. Changes.
Man, thou may change me, but I can't trace time. One of those events was the arrival of the Andy Warhol penned play, Pork, at the Roundhouse in London. The play was an over-the-top performance, complete with masturbation, nudity, and simulated shit-eating. It was actually chocolate pudding. David already had an affinity for Warhol due to his connection to the Velvet Underground, so after catching a performance, he made his way backstage to meet the cast. He instantly connected with their brash personalities and their ability to fully commit to outlandish characters on the stage. That fall, David and Angie flew to New York to formally sign the RCA paperwork. The label made him feel like a rock star for the first time in his life, booking him in the high-end Warwick Hotel in the same suite Elvis stayed in. When he arrived to the room, he was greeted with a large display featuring Elvis's full vinyl catalog. The message from the label was plain and simple. You are our next Elvis.
Lord Almighty, I feel my temperature rising. Higher, higher, it's burning through to my soul.
While in New York City, Bowie reconnected with the cast of Pork, and he was invited to the legendary dance club known as The Factory. At the club, he was introduced to one of his heroes, Andy Warhol. Upon meeting the pop artist, Bowie rambled on about his admiration. Warhol coldly responded, "I like your yellow shoes." Eventually, Warhol warmed up to Bowie, and David even got a chance to play the hunky-dory song named Andy Warhol on acoustic guitar. Warhol liked the song, although he took offense to the line, "Andy Warhol looks a scream."
Like to take a cement fix, biggest standing cinema. Dress my friends up just for show, see them as they really are. Put the people in my brain, two new pens to have a go. I'd like to be a gallery, put you all inside my show.
Andy Warhol looks a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
Upon David's request, RCA set up a meeting with his Velvet Underground idol, Lou Reed. Now a solo artist, the fellow RCA musician agreed to meet his admirer for lunch at a Chinese restaurant. As Bowie gushed over his idol, Reed responded with eye rolls, sneers, and diffidence. Bowie was starstruck. Reed was annoyed. Here's Bowie talking about how intimidated he was by the encounter.
I had so many ideas and I felt so intimidated by my knowledge of the work that he'd already done. I mean, even though there was sort of only that much time between us, it seemed like Lou had this great legacy of work, which indeed he did have.
In his defense, Lou Reed was going through a rough time, struggling with drug addiction and disappointment in the sales of his first solo release. Bowie wasn't let down by the first meeting, though. In fact, he compartmentalized the dejected nature of Reed, and he told his hero as he left, "I hope we see each other again. This has been such a thrill for me." Bowie had one more idol to meet in the incorrigible Iggy Pop. At the time, Iggy and the Stooges had taken a break due to his struggle with heroin addiction. He was staying in New York at the home of Danny Fields, a representative from Elektra Records, where he was watched closely in order to try and clean him up. Here's Danny Field talking about Iggy at his lowest point.
I was in the bathroom looking for Iggy. Good time to get ready. And I looked under the stalls, and there was Iggy lying on the floor, passed out with a needle in his arm. He was a junkie. He was a junkie. He was on heroin.
When Bowie arrived, Iggy didn't pay much attention, staring blankly at a TV in an opiate haze as Bowie expressed his love of the Stooges. Eventually, Iggy perked up to David's compliments, and he began talking with him about music. At the end of their meeting, Bowie said, "Let's work together someday." Iggy would later talk about the importance of this first meeting.
Had he not come along with that proposal, I probably wouldn't be talking to you. No.
Really?
I'd be playing somewhere, probably in 42nd Street or something, you know, something like that. So it was a good stroke, you know.
Seeing two of his favorite musicians at their lowest affected David deeply. As he flew back to the UK, he began thinking about the idea of the fallen rock star, a godlike figure brought back down to earth, and what it must feel like to go through such a fall from grace. Ideas that had been swirling around in his head for the past year, his dress-up band The Hype, the over-the-top theatrics of Warhol's Pork, his fallen heroes, all of it began to coalesce into what would become one of the most innovative creations in rock and roll history. He would take on a new persona, Ziggy Stardust. The name Ziggy was a play on Iggy, and Stardust was a tribute to the legendary Stardust Cowboy. Ziggy Stardust's backstory will be based on early 60s rock star Vince Taylor, who lost his mind and believed he could communicate with God, aliens, and even thought he was the next coming of Christ. Here's Bowie describing the Taylor concert that inspired Ziggy's origin story.
He'd gone on stage without his band, but dressed in white robes and told everybody that indeed he was the coming Messiah. And he just got booed off. I mean, they just went mad, and it was like the end of his career. And that one day, I remember on Tottenham Court Road, he dragged out this world map, and we were crouching on all fours outside Tottenham Court Road tube station. And he was showing me where all the aliens had their bases throughout the, under the Arctic and like in this mountain. And there's people stepping over our map, and I think, what the hell am I doing in the middle of Russia with this bonkers American looking at the map of the world? And he's telling me, and I thought, there's something in this. I'm going to remember this. This is just too good.
Once again, Bowie would draw inspiration from the works of Stanley Kubrick, this time the film Clockwork Orange. He wanted Ziggy's band to be similar to the Droogs in the film, a street gang that followed the demented Alex around the streets of London. They would be called the Spiders and be given names Guiley and Weird. Ronson kept his name for unknown reasons. Bowie called his childhood friend George Underwood and asked him to draw sketches of what the otherworldly Ziggy Stardust and his band of hoodlums might look like. The result of these sketches was what we know today as Ziggy Stardust. One part spaceman, one part kabuki dancer, one part androgynous sex symbol. His hair would be a wild original style, colored bright red, long in the back, shorter in the front. It was the mullet way before the world of hockey and Billy Ray Cyrus had discovered it. While working on his upcoming project, Bowie did an interview with Melody Maker, where he told reporter Michael Watts that he was gay. Here's George Underwood talking about the impact of this interview.
That was incredibly brave, very brave.
News of Bowie's bisexuality began making the tabloid rounds, and within weeks, sales of Hunky Dory began to rise, and excitement grew for the next project that he hinted at in the interview. Months later, Bowie's concept album, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, was released. While Hunky Dory had been a laid-back, intimate, piano-driven album, Ziggy Stardust was big guitar riffs, upbeat tempos, and larger-than-life attitude. It took Mark Bolan's glam rock to the next level. The album opens with 5 years, a song that introduces the storyline. The news is just broken that the Earth only has 5 years left.
Pushing through the market square, so many mothers sighing. News had just come over, we had 5 years left crying. News guy wept and told us, was really dying. Cried so much his face was wet. Then I knew he was not lying. I heard telephones, opera house, favorite melodies. I saw boys, toys, electric irons and TVs. A brain.
Two tracks later, A Messiah Is Born on Moon Age Daydream, a song that tells of the rise of a fallen rock star in Ziggy Stardust, an awakening that is one part religious, one part technological, and one part sexual.
I'm an alligator. I'm a mama papa coming for you. I'm a space invader. I'll be a rock and rolling bitch for you. Your mouth shut. You're squawking like a big monkey bird. And I'm busting up a brain for the world. Ooh. Keep your electric car on me, babe. Ooh. Put your ray gun to my head. Ooh. Press your space base.
On the next track, entitled Starman, Ziggy is advised in a dream by the infinites in space. They tell him to write a song entitled Starman that will let the people know there's still hope in these dire times. This hope comes in the form of a spaceman who will eventually come down and save humanity.
Didn't know what time it was, the lights were low, oh. Then the loud sound that seemed to fight came back like a slow voice on a wave of fight. That weren't no DJ, that was hazy cosmic time.
There's a starman.
The rest of the album continues with the narrative. Lady Stardust tells of Ziggy's past as a rock star, while Hang On To Yourself and Star give the album an upbeat, celebratory tone of the hope that will come with the Starman. The title track plays as the climax of the story, with Ziggy playing to an exultant crowd, but they quickly turn to enraged by the end when they realize that these visions are all bogus. The final verse of the song is the final nail in the career of Ziggy. Quote, Ziggy sucked up into his mind like a leper messiah. When the kids had killed the man, I had to break up the band. Here's Ziggy Stardust.
Ziggy played guitar, jamming good with Webb and Gilly and the spiders from Mars. He played it left hand, but made it too far. Became the special man, then we were Ziggy's band. Ziggy really sang, screwed up eyes and screwed down hairdo. Like some cat from Japan, he could lick 'em by smiling. He could leave 'em to hang. Became on so loaded, man. Well hung in snow white tan.
The resolution to this epic tale arrives on the final two tracks, Suffragette City and Rock and Roll Suicide. The world returns to their hopeless future of damnation, but instead of wallowing in fear, the masses start a wild, carefree orgy fueled by the music of Ziggy. Even though his vision for the future failed, he was able to change the dread of end times into a free-for-all love fest. Here's Suffragette City. I know on past episodes I haven't played this many tracks from one album, but I couldn't resist. Ziggy Stardust is a classic in every sense of the word. Its innovation in sound, its wild, adventurous storytelling and imagery, and of course the stage presence that came with the new persona. The first Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars show took place before 60 people in Tolworth. By the end of the tour, they would play before 14,000 at Earl's Court Exhibition Center. Needless to say, the album catapulted David's career. All of those years of failure had finally paid off in ways he couldn't have imagined. Starman rose up the charts, and as a result, Bowie and his band appeared on Top of the Pops. 3 years earlier, he'd been on the same show, a meek, shy young singer performing Space Oddity. But this second appearance was very different. As Ziggy Stardust, he could be brash, confident, and outlandish. Here's David at that time describing the feeling of escape he got as Ziggy Stardust.
I believe in my part all the way down the line, right the way down. But I do play it for all it's worth, because that's the way I do my stage thing. That's part of what Bowie's supposed to be all about. I'm an actor.
For many musicians, seeing this performance in their childhood was an unforgettable, life-changing moment. Synth pop artist Gary Numan said, "That performance stands out as one of the most pivotal moments in modern music. It was simply being sucked in by that larger-than-life, slightly unreal persona that makes people want to be more than they are." Ian McCulloch of Echo and the Bunnymen said of the performance, "I was only 13, but I watched Top of the Pops and I thought, maybe I was Ziggy Stardust all along." David Gahan of Depeche Mode said, "Bowie represented a way for me to get out of myself, to escape where I was. He just wasn't of this earth. And that was really attractive to me, to live in a different persona." Susie Sue watched the episode from a hospital bed, suffering from ulcerative colitis. She said, "That performance meant such a lot. I was in a room where all kinds of people were coughing their guts up or walking around with blood hanging from a cradle on a support. He provided joy in that moment." Bowie was finally the biggest rock star in Britain like he'd always dreamed of. Now it was time to take over America. Bowie takes on the US of A next time on Year of the Bowie.
Someone so picked on you, boom, boom. Hey, that's far out, so you hurt him too, boom, boom. Switch on the TV, we may pick him up on channel 2. Look out your window, I can see his light. We can sparkle, he may land tonight. Don't tell your papa, he'll get us locked up in fright.